This episode was recorded prior to Biz Markie's passing. On behalf of the Legendized podcast staff, Marley Marl and myself, DJ Caliban, we offer our heartfelt condolences to Biz's family, friends, and Juice Crew brothers and sisters. May Biz Markie's soul rest forever in peace. His memory and music will always live on.
Hey, yo, it's the legendary DJ Marley Marl.
Alongside Caliban.
Right now, you're checking out the Legendized podcast. On this podcast, we go beyond the origin stories of hip-hop's greatest artists.
And producers, and the classic records they made.
That's what's up.
Legendized.
1, 2, we back in the house. Woo-wee, episode 8 right now. What's going on, Caliban?
How are you feeling, Marley?
Feeling real good, man. This Legendized thing is going real good. I'm getting a lot of response off of this shit right here.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's blowing me up on IG.
That's what's going on. You see them likes going up and followers going up?
Yeah, I got real followers. My numbers are real.
That's what's up.
You ready to jump into this Hot Topics?
Ooh, Hot Topics.
It's here. Live music is back. But you still might have to wait on arena shows.
Why is that?
Well, because people want to smoothly get back into the festivals.
Right.
Artists are announcing tour dates, but they got to do it way in advance.
Right.
And like one of the first people to actually do it up and put it out there is Elton John.
Ooh, okay. All right. I'm a little suspect, though. I'm not ready to DJ in front of no crowd yet.
No?
I'm not going to do it. I'm going to have to sit this fucking summer out. Because I'm not ready for all that.
You're not ready for the live performance?
Nah. You know, to be straight honest, because before the pandemic, if I was around crowds, I would go home and get sick the next day because I'm not the person that really be around a lot of people anyway.
True.
So by the time, you know, everybody's breathing on me and touching all over me and trying to take pictures with me and act like they knew me a million years, you know, I would go home and get sick.
A lot of bacteria floating around.
Yeah, it's definitely. And, you know, and I was definitely... I could say it again. I was fucking with masks before the pandemic.
Right. Well, it's definitely not really a health concern when it comes to arenas. It's more of road crews getting together.
Come on. You got to think. If everybody's hollering and you're on stage and they hollering towards you.
Oh, my God.
that's a lot of stuff coming at you.
Projectiles.
Yeah, everything.
Of saliva could possibly be floating in the air.
It's a whole concert of people. And you're on stage. And they're like, ah! And I don't think I'm ready for that yet.
So would you prefer that any club you DJ, that the people admitted have to show proof of vaccination?
How about let's do it remotely?
It's getting there.
I know.
Some DJs are still doing parties remotely.
Yeah, no doubt.
They're going to be doing arenas remotely?
I would love to see that. I would love to do an arena from the crib. I mean, everybody's capable right now.
That's right.
Everybody's capable. So you could do concerts from the crib.
Well, summer jams are coming up across the nation. You know, all the... urban stations are throwing their
here
summer
in New
jams.
York, in I got to say, Summer Jam is back here at Hot 97 here in New York
City.
Yes,
it is.
That's going to be something to see because that's the first time a lot of people is going to be unchained in an arena.
In more ways than one.
Right. You know, it's a lot going to be going on. And if
yes,
they just used to bum rush the stage, I remember, why do people used to go to Summer Jam and not have a ticket and just try to rush when there's like 4 or 5 things of security.
Yeah,
like,
after
you're rushing past the first group, but you got a whole nother group before you even get to your seats.
Yes,
and what are you going to do? Just keep running in a circle once you get in the damn arena?
It's like sitting in the parking lot. But arenas are starting to open up, and they will start to come your way. So live music is definitely back, and arenas will be popping off sooner than later.
Yeah.
Producer Timbaland is about to transform the music production business once again.
Once again.
Yes, he's creating a beat club.
Okay.
The launching of his platform called Beat Club alongside his long-term manager, Gary Mariella.
Mm-hmm.
They're creating a platform where independent artists could actually get beats from well-known producers.
Okay. I got you.
So independent music.
Timbaland got hits. But if I was Timbaland, I would stop putting those little things up he's putting up on the internet. I mean, it just doesn't. He doesn't do nothing for me.
Like the production secrets or?
I mean, you see him in the little videos. It's like playing beats and with this little spaceship behind him, like a spaceship. I mean, I don't know if that's doing it for him because Timbaland is better than that. He's bigger than that.
Would you be in favor of allowing some of your music to openly be heard by global independent artists or just to reach out to you and?
No, I don't got the time for that no more. I'm done with it, man. It's too ignorant out there. It's too much, you know, I can't deal with the bottom of the barrel. Like, I can't. Because we're dealing with the bottom of the barrel here.
Well, I mean, yeah, everyone now has access, has so much more access, you know, to the information highway.
Yeah, they say that.
And you're more accessible. Well, you can make yourself more accessible, rather.
Yeah, you could. But when you put your shit up on platforms and you see nobody's buying it and you're still pushing it on the internet like this shit is popping, it's like ridiculous.
What about discovering new independent artists?
If you're an artist and you nice and you cut that cloth and you get across, yeah. But if you're a motherfucker that just keep putting your shit, don't send me your shit and you got like 2 views or don't send me your shit early. Don't do that because... When I'm looking at artists, I'm looking at motherfuckers put their shit up on platforms. And, you know, if your shit ain't moving, that means people not into you like that. You get what I'm saying? It's like right there showing you that motherfuckers don't give a fuck.
So would you base people's talent also on how many followers they have?
If you got it popping and people's following you like that and they trying to be like you, yeah, you have a certain talent.
What about those who aren't really into social media, but they can, like, sing or spit?
Social media is for dummies, for real. It's like, it's seriously, it's for dummies. And, you know, a lot of people acting like what they're really not. You know, you go to their house, they sat in some other corner and where it was kind of cool and shit, and that's cool part of the house they're filming. You go see their cars, like, missing hubcaps.
It's just not aligned to reality.
It's not aligned to reality. It's like... You could just go on the internet and act like you anything that you're not and tell stories. You could make up shit. And if you wasn't even really there, that's why I hate the internet. Because motherfuckers could just go start talking shit, making up shit for likes.
Right.
Because
right.
They you know, they see a little angle like, oh, people don't really like him like that. So let me nudge in over there on what they don't like about him and act like I got some fuel for that. But you're still a sucker, though. You wasn't there. You get what I'm saying? And that's what I don't like about the internet.
There's a lot more opportunities for people to be more fake than ever.
You know, a lot of people fronting ass people act like, and you could also look too like, damn, this motherfucker believed that nigga, you following him, so.
It's just another a chain way reaction.
To find it. It's a chain reaction of stupidness.
Well, Timbaland created this specific beat club because they kept on discovering more and more independent artists on social media.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he felt that this would be a way to work with various amounts of independent artists around the world. And the importance of independent artists has grown increasingly with the pandemic. So he wanted to open it up.
That's dope. A lot of artists. Let me tell you something. These guys trying to be artists, too. Be careful what you ask for, because you might get what you ask for. That's all I could tell you. And sometimes you might realize, like DMX said, that you ain't like these motherfuckers. You get what I'm saying? That's what I realized too early. I wasn't like the motherfuckers. I wouldn't do anything to get famous. Motherfuckers right now will do anything to get famous. And people know that and they prey on that.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to have the guests that we do have. That way they can tell you straight from their mouths everything that they went through to get where they're at today.
Yeah, sometimes, man, you might get what you asked for and then you might realize not what the fuck you wanted.
Ah, legendize. Well, let's discuss this further with our next guest for this episode, Banger.
Let me tell you about this dude before we get him on the microphone. He's considered one of the greatest hip-hop producers of all time.
He is one half of the hip-hop duo Gangstar alongside Guru, R.I.P.
His production has a pronounced style and the sound that is easy to recognize. Every time you hear a beat, your head is bopping.
Born in the Fifth Ward of Houston, Texas, and attended Prairie View A&M University, where he honed his musical skills as the campus DJ and also occasionally performed with the Marching Storm Band.
Made Brooklyn, New York his home. And he openly states
that who?
That me, DJ Marley Marl, is his number one inspiration.
Ooh. For its 20th anniversary issue in 2008, The Source selected this man on its list of the top 20 greatest producers in the magazine's history and top five hip-hop producers of all time.
Grammys for D'Angelo, Jay-Z, Christina Aguilera, my man, my nigga,
DJ, a.k.a. DJ Premier, Premier.
I think I have an applause sound effect on this road box. Oh, shit, King of Chill trying to reach for the button. Oh, okay. All right, there you go. Oh, hold on, I think this is it.
What up, Primo?
What's going on, Marley? What's up, Caliban?
Good to see you, Prime, always.
Yeah, good to be here, man. I wish I could have been there in person. I just got back from a baseball tournament. I've been in Florida for a whole week with my son's. He's in a travel league.
Dope.
And he's 9 years old, but we've been gone, so I literally just got back. That's why when they were saying, could I come to you in person, which I'd rather do, especially for you. You know, when Marley asks, just yes. It's just like, yeah, where you need me? Oh, Flying Saucer, I'll be there. You know, I'll be standing there in the Close Encounters area and they can just swoop me up and shit. But yeah, it's always good to be here, man. So the Electronic Music Collective, like the room is crazy. Like what kind of setup is that?
Well, over here at Electronic Music Collective, they teach DJing, they teach, you know, how to use the latest software and stuff like that. So there's like rooms and rooms of turntables, software. It's like a producer's dream here. You come up in here, you don't want to even go outside.
Oh, that's crazy. I gotta come by there.
Come down and bless us with your presence.
Yeah, I'll come too, man. You know, this is just the beginning of it.
It's like how Dub Spot used to be. This is Dub Spot on steroids.
Yeah.
that's why I'm looking in the background like, damn. 1, 2, 3, 4, like, yeah. And the thing is, even just learning to work equipment, we all of us DJs knew how to plug in a mixer and turntables and mics, but you've always been really ahead on the latest thing before it became the latest thing. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
Like you were already up on it. I mean, were you the type to just hear about or check out this new machine, or you were just even doing your own research before it got to popping?
I mean, with me, when it came to sampling back in the day, I was an intern at Unique Recording. So in the early days, my boy Andre brought me over there. Is how I got started with the studio stuff. I was a DJ. Andre and them just plugged into my equipment in the park, and they started jamming with me. Then the next thing you know, all the musicians is coming to my house now. I'm like,
you talking about Andre Booth?
Yeah, Andre Booth, yeah.
Andre Booth.
So
wow,
he got me. He took me to my first session was Jazzy Sensation with Bam Bottom.
You know, Tommy Boy.
Oh. Yeah.
Check us out with our Jazzy Sensation. Can you feel it? Can you feel it? Our Jazzy Sensation.
Okay. That was my first session. I just sat in. He brought me to Unique, and that's when I met the owners of Unique. And I was like, yo, this is an environment. This shit is dope.
Wow.
So I started like running for coffee for them, just hanging around, seeing sessions. I seen them force them D's make Let Me Love You. You know what I'm saying? It's like a lot of stuff was happening there. So
let me love you in the sunshine. Let me hold you, baby, all night.
I was already familiar with samplers, but everybody was using it for the other reason. They wasn't using it for the same reason I was using it gonna use it for. So I was seeing already the Arthur Bakers, the dopest engineers came from Unique back in the day, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
The Allergy Brothers come from Unique. I used to watch them.
That's so dope. you get what I'm saying, man. Do you think your DJing applied all to production and mixing and just hearing how you hear things? Versus the person that just produces, that doesn't DJ at all, and you know how to play the right records in a club or even on mix show, you know.
100% of my DJing made me a better producer, made me the producer to the next level because the other producers at that point wasn't DJs, so I had that advantage. Right. You know, being a DJ, you already know what to play at the club at what time, mm-hmm. what's gonna work. So when you're making records, you should be making records when you know it's going to work.
King of Chill was just, we saying that the other day. He said, if you notice, that's why you started getting Latin Rascals remixes and it would even say edited by them. Because we all learned from cutting tape where, you know, that's, I learned how to edit and cut tape, which I didn't know at first. Mm-hmm. Because we're from that era where, you know, a lot of these guys were DJs as well. And that's why they were more in demand when it came to getting, you know, production before the additional hip hop producers that came into the world got down to be a part of it.
That's right. I mean, I think the DJs have a certain edge over the average because, you know, they know the crowd, you know, they know what to do. It's kind of, it's almost like a performing artist, too, because a performing artist that's on that stage and they know how to work the crowd, they know what kind of records to make to work the crowd. That's an advantage, too.
We had Clark Kent on the show a couple of episodes ago, and I asked him the same question, how did DJing play a part in his production? And he was talking about how it helped him because he knew the records and he knew the breakbeats, he knew what samples to use. But Marley had always told me, he was like, you know, we got an advantage as a DJ first. His theory was that in terms of the sound, we knew where to do the drops, where to put the mutes and the edits, because as a DJ, we know how it would excite the crowd or how it would move the crowd. Is that how you also feel, Prem?
Yeah, 100%. It's like, you can just hear a line in a song and it makes you want to take the music out at this spot and then put it back here and maybe drop the snare but keep the hi-hat and then put one kick and then take it all back out. And then you just kind of know.
Yeah.
You know?
It's that feel, right?
Yeah. Right, so your Primo, man, take me back to the Fifth Ward. Take me back to your early childhood in Texas. What type of music was inspiring you as a kid when you was growing up?
Yeah. What was playing in your house?
Well, my early childhood, you know, I was a baby, so
and Sesame Street was dope.
Sesame Street was rocking. that and the Little Rascals, Alfalfa and Stiney, and
right.
We all, Buckwheat. I mean, even though it was foul, we all know Buckwheat. Word. You know, glad you got older. It's like, yo, they being foul this month. But, we loved Ote well. Right. But my mom is an art teacher. God bless her soul. She passed a year ago. But she taught art when I was in junior high and when I went to high school. She would fluctuate. She used to teach in our rival school. She taught high school art, and then she went to my school and taught me in high school and like I said, in junior high, because she was a librarian, but mainly for art. But in the house, all she did was paint every day. You know, so as a kid, she was the one that had, let me clear my throat. She was the one who had all the records. And obviously in 71, you know, I was five when I was in 70, I'm 55 now. So yeah, in 71, I was about to go to kindergarten, but to see the record, it to me, it looked like a toy, you know, to see a Motown record. And the way it spun around, it looked like a toy to me. So I was fascinated by everything that she chose. When she put it on the record player, it's not like the music matched the way the label looked. You know what I mean? Like, if that makes sense. It's like, I remember she had one of the big records that she was playing in the crib was Want Ads by Honeycomb. And the label was bugged out. Look, I was like, damn, it don't look like Motown, but it looked funky and soulful. Tell you what I'm gonna do. You know what I'm saying? And when you put it on, like you said, it matched. I used to say that about artists. Like when you hear EPMD and you see what they look like, they match. When you hear Shan and you see him, it's like, damn, he looked like a Shan, like Shan. You know what I'm saying? Nas, you know, Nas look like Nas. I feel like me and Guru look like Gangstar. When you used to hear the music and see us, they matched. You know, so same thing with P.E. and Eric being Rakim and BDP.
Little Nas X.
Yeah, him too. You know what I'm saying? Well, he went from Cowboy to all the way. You know what I'm saying? But because Old Town Road was a good record. Nobody can front on
doubt,
that.
No doubt.
You know, you can't front on that. I sang that shit just as much as everybody else did. And it was a good record. I'll never front on a good record. Good music is good music, man.
That's real talk.
So when you went to Brooklyn, or you were staying with your grandfather, did the music shift or change in terms of what you were listening to?
My grandfather Bill, his name is William Manuel, but we called him Grandfather Bill. Rest in peace to him and his wife, Rooney. He was in a jazz band. So when we used to stay over there, he would always play his trombone, his trumpet, and he had a guitar. So he would always just play all this music around the house, and he always was singing, you know. So just hearing him was another reason why. And he was always showing me everywhere he went, like, oh, this is when I was in Paris, and this is at the so-and-so club. And they, I mean, he had mad pictures. I was like, wow, you got to fly all over the world in Europe to do this. And he was in World War II. So all of that made me go, man, one day I could probably do that. And this is really when the hip hop era is just still growing, you know, because obviously we come back, we come from the disco era all the way, you know, going into, it's just like I tell people, I graduated high school in 84. So Purple Rain was like our, right before we graduate, movie to go see. And we all, you know, load up and go to the theater and watch it 8 times and stuff. So prior to any of that, we're influenced and pay homage to all of those classic soul and disco and rock records that built the whole foundation of hip hop culture.
Your freestyle was hip hop back in the day.
Yeah,
that's real talk.
You're right. You're right.
AEIOU. Debbie Deb.
Yeah.
Just everything. Set It Off. Well, Set It Off. It goes in the freestyle category because you have a lot of the Italians that I know. It's like Set It Off comes on, and like that's my jam. They know the words, you know.
Set it off.
They bucking in the sky.
But my mom is the biggest influence because she had so much vinyl. You know what I'm saying? And we had 8-track tapes. You know, she wasn't really a cassette collector until she got older, but 8-tracks and just you know, all the album covers when they open up and all of that stuff, man, is what built us to still be great at an older age. I don't think if we didn't have that to be raised on, we wouldn't keep it funky, so to speak, like we continue to do. You know, I think that's the reason why we're funkier. It's not even against the younger generation or anybody else, because there's people our age that's whack now. That was dope, you know, back in the day, and they're whack now. You know, dope shit will always get played by me when I do my radio show and still break records. Whack shit, just I'm not playing it. No favors. I think when you don't do favors, the trust is more there, you know, to make sure that what I'm playing for you is something that needs some airplay.
That's true.
You still work in a record store?
Yeah, I used to work in a record store called Sound Waves, which was actually right across the street from this club called the Rhinestone Wrangler. It was literally across the street from the Astrodome. You know what I'm saying? So
in Texas.
It was called Sound Waves. Now, this one's in the neighborhood. So everybody, all the pimps that would throw parties would come there because they would buy all the, you know, all the players. They come in there with the snakeskin shoes
and the gators.
Just before gold fronts, just a whole bunch of gold teeth and, you know, the straw hat, you know, cocktails, deuce. And they just like, yo, man. And this one dude used to always come in there and go, hey, man, you got some new Latimo. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, yeah, right down the wall. You know, yeah, how many Latimo records you got? Not Latimore, Latimo.
Latimo.
You know what I'm saying? And at Soundwave, you had to know every genre of music or you couldn't get a job there. And I knew everything because I have older sisters who was into rock, you know, and just, you know, even the new wave sound and all that stuff. So, which is also part of, you know, Tainted Love is a dope record. It come on, the hip hop heads know the words. And they're like, man, turn that corny shit off. They know what it is.
Take my tears and that's not really all Tainted Love. Tainted Love.
Right.
So, but my mom, keep rewinding back, goes back to her. She always went record shopping every week, and she would be like, yo, I'm going record shopping. You want to go? And I'd go with her, and she'd be like, get to buy any three records you want.
Wow.
And it's pretty much anything that she was into because their music we enjoyed at the same time, from Aretha to Minnie Riperton, Natalie Cole, you know, mm-hmm. obviously Curtis Mayfield, mm-hmm. Barry White, and all them automatic. Like, that's just automatic in our household. You know, mm-hmm. Benny Barry White, Love Unlimited.
You're the one. You're the one I need.
I mean, even Rolls Royce, when Car Wash came out, mm-hmm. they're considered new, but mm-hmm. they were in the household.
At the car wash, working at the car wash, yeah.
You know, New Birth and Mandrill, just wow. all these albums, man, you know, Confunction. And then she was into Stanley Turrentine and mm-hmm. Grover Washington Jr., Herbie Mann. You know, just everything. And she had all these records. And then Motown, you have everything. You know, that's just automatic. Mm-hmm. My mom, I had a neighbor named Ms. Whiting. And rest in peace to her and her husband. They lived about 4 or 5 houses down. And she's always giving 45s to just have. And my mom would always be like, oh, Ms. Whiting, got some more 45s for you. One day I went down there, took her last stash. She calls my mom and was like, yo, I done ran out of records to give him. What do I do? She goes, oh, I'm just take all the ones that you gave him, give them back to you. He's not going to know the difference.
Recycle
them again.
Free gifts.
She gives me one that she already gave me. I go back to the house. My mom's like, yes, this Ms. Whiting gave some records today. I say, yeah, but something's, I think she's kind of, you know, tripping because she's giving me the same records I already had. My mother's like, damn, cause can't fool this kid, you know.
You were DJing already?
Nah, just... They would have their house parties and Chris is going to play the records. You know, Chris is my real name. Uh-huh. Chris is going to play the records and I'll just put it on. Well, for one, my mother said, when you grab a record, I'll pretend this phone's the record. She said, you hold it like this.
Yeah, my father told me, hold,
you
don't touch
put
it.
One
yeah.
fingerprint on the top, that's your ass and you're getting we call it a whooping. You're getting a whooping. And, you know, I would do my best like not to touch it because you want to put it on the record player with your thumbs on the top, you know, but she said, hold it like this. And for a long time, you know, so we started sampling and doing all that. Now we just throw it on there and just needle around. But there's still a certain care that you have as a DJ. I mean, it's a weird position to play unless you're diehard about it from every aspect of it, which we are. Mm-hmm. You know, but the records and all of that come straight from her. And especially the day we go record shopping, that was always fun.
That's dope. You remember record shopping, Molly?
Yeah, my uncle used to have a record store in Queensbridge called Top 10. So I used to get all that good shit.
Oh, so you just go
can
to
we
the spot.
Rewind back to that time and
you know what I mean?
And go back to that store.
Man, my grandfather used to take me to the Wiz on Jamaica Avenue.
What? Yeah, we had Top 10 in Queensbridge. They used to sell the little candies. Little packy packs in the back too.
Legendize.
This is the story of how a film gets made. Starring Josh Rubin.
It's his first feature.
You Were the Worst's Aya Cash.
Can we not do this right now?
And SNL's Chris Redd.
He's not doing it for a paycheck.
Okay. I see y'all.
Join us for the making of Scare Me, a horror comedy from the brilliant mind of Josh Rubin.
This year you're gonna make a movie no matter what.
Tear down the fourth wall of filmmaking with our crack team of investigators.
Don't you come at me and try to get me to spill some stuff.
This is Make Cool Shit, hosted by Aaron Hieffetz.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Season 1, Make a Movie.
3, 2, 1.
Everywhere you enjoy podcasts.
So I guess I'm going to learn the film business.
Legendize.
Yo, so take me back. Let's go to when you got the urge to move to New York. What year was that?
To actually make the move?
Yeah.
Right.
Was 87, late 87, but knowing I wanted to had to be about 82 when It's Like That came out. Because I remember my best friend.
Oh, Run DMC.
We were going to football practice and he put me onto the song.
Don't act. I don't know why, but it's like that. And that's
And when I finally found it, it was only a 12-inch single. It wasn't even on a cassette single. There weren't even cassette singles yet. Mm-hmm. And there were no albums, you know. So, and then not only that, I was really fascinated by the disco single because I'm like, yo, you mean there's a longer version on a single that looks like an album size, but it's only one song on one side, and Casablanca didn't have anything on the other side. And I was man, these are unique. You know, I always put the needle on the side that has nothing to it. Slide it off, you know, just to watch it just go, you know. So I was just fascinated by, you know, that's what it used to be called before maxi single or 12-inch. It would say disco single. Yeah, and then once it got to the stage of hip-hop being on there, you know, and seeing the two songs on there, and then about 84, there was, you know, Def Jam started doing that thing, and then you dropped Dimples D, you know, which was Party Time, which also is how, the first time we ever saw the Def Jam logo later, you know, mm-hmm. after Dimples D, mm-hmm. when It's Yours dropped.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Did it Yours come before Dimples D or after?
It's Yours came before. Mm-hmm. It came before.
Yeah. Man, that shit right there was... It's Yours is just one of the most incredible records.
Do you like it?
Yeah!
Do you want it?
Yeah!
Well, if you had it, would you flaunt it?
Hell yeah!
Well, it's yours.
You know, Sucker DJs from Dimples D. She was from Queensbridge, too?
Yeah, she was definitely from 12th Street, 41 side. Actually, she's from the next building from Havoc.
Wow.
She's from the next building from Havoc. I believe their windows was facing each other, so...
Damn, that was a lot of history. That record was so dope.
When the time was up, they just couldn't believe what the man Marley Marl has just achieved. To get the people dancing on the wackiest jam, cause Marley Marl is one hell of a man. So to those DJs that think you're the greatest, just stop looking, listen, cause you haven't heard the latest.
You know, and I remember when they just started to play a rap video every now and then, we saw the Roxanne Shanté, Roxanne's mm-hmm. Revenge. And I was just like, yo.
My name is Roxanne, and they call me Shanté. But every time of that, I say a rhyme, I just like a dissa. It ain't nothing, you MC when I miss it.
I got to do this. So, yeah, around 82, 83 is when I said, I got to move to New York because for us, you know, everything was either records coming out of Philly, but they were predominantly New York records, but they always had Philly addresses on it with pop art and all that stuff. Yeah. We did, you know, we was, you know, wanting to figure it all out and make sure we understood all of that stuff, you know, from all the Tommy Boy stuff with Planet Rock and, you know, just, I was like, I have to be where it is. If it was in Kentucky, I would have been in Kentucky getting down with the hip hop there. But since New York was the place, and I was, as a little kid, we've always gone to New York to stay with my grandfather because my mother's from Baltimore. We would go to Baltimore first, fly there, and then drive to New York, you know, and stay with my grandfather. So it was always a summer trip that we did every single year, all the way up to me being 13. Around 13, I was like, Mom, I want to do it on my own and just hang out with grandfather, you know, because he and I were tight. We were into sports. He used to take me to the Yankees games all the time. And we were really into just spending a lot of time with music and taking me to Playland in Times Square to play pinball because I was real good at pinball. Mm. And then going to Yankee games, you know. So all of that let me know by 13, 14. I said, this is definitely what I'm going to do. I just got to figure out. I didn't understand the concept of how to make a demo. And I didn't even make beats back then, you know. I didn't start making beats really until me and Guru met.
So who were your hip hop influences when you were still in Texas before you came to New York?
Producer, artist?
Artist.
Well, obviously Run DMC is automatic. Sugar Hill Gang and all that, set it off with, you know, them Treacherous 3, Grandmaster Flash and Furious 5, all that Sugar Hill stuff. But, everything on Enjoy Records, you know, that whole 1979 era had us already open. And then when it came down to it moving forward, you know, Larry Smith, I was a big fan of anything he produced, you know, from Houdini to, I had a good interview with Davey DMX about all of this stuff. You know, he was explaining to me about Jimmy Spicer and how that, all of that stuff linked up and the Orange Crush.
Yes.
I want action. I'm a lady on the move. I need action.
obviously what Russell was doing, because, you know, when Christmas Rapping came out with Curtis Blow, we were just like, what is this? You know, like,
right.
This is a totally different type of rap. It's cleaner, but it bumps, you know. And
it plays every year.
Yeah, exactly. Kurt got to be getting checks, man.
He was rolling, he was bully, and I said, holy moly, you got a lot of wishes on your chinny chin chin. He allowed, he was proud of the hairy little crowd on the point of the door where the skin should have been.
You know, so all of that made me go, I want to do this. And then when you came out with the sampling part, because I know first it was just drum machines, from the stock sounds that it comes with, but when you started just making shit sound dirty and dusty and just how you programmed it, because that's what I always tell people now, even with me. There's stuff I've worked on where somebody gave me the record, but they didn't hook it up. They didn't turn on the drum machine. They did not
say that. Hold up, say that one more time.
Push the buttons. Do
say,
that.
Say that one more time. Just say that one more time.
I said
for the people in the back.
I've worked with artists that have given me the record and say, yo, I want you to hook this up. But they're not sitting there telling me how to do it. They're just like, yo, I want to do a beat off of this.
Right.
I'm sitting there truncated, doing the buttons, catching, ooh, it'd be dope like this, flying it in. Ooh, nah, not that part.
Tapping
this part.
Out that hi-hat on there.
Yep.
Putting that 808 up under there like, in the right spot.
Yeah, and then place it like
did y'all hear that in the cheap seats? Y'all up in the cheap seats. Did y'all hear that?
And with the DJ ear, we know how it needs to be hooked up before we get it going right.
No doubt.
And then boom. No doubt. It's almost like directing a band. Horn goes there, stop right there,
right.
Put a delay right there on that word, you know, that you could tell even when I used to listen to all your stuff and study you. I was like, yo, he always puts the delay there on this part of the line when they say, you know, and it was always just that signature delay where I was like, why is he putting it there? And you know, just it's like I was doing everything that I could do to just figure out how your brain ticks. And I was like, yo, now I get it. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I told you had one of the illest drum rolls of all time with the bridge, man. Even the way the record looked, it just said bridge records and that kind of off bluish green color. And just all you heard was
like.
Dude, you like that drum roll is so hard.
Yo, you should have seen it the first time I played it in Queensbridge at the park. When that niggas didn't know what the fuck that was. It was like drums. It was like gunshots. Pat ta 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 ta. Like,
man,
yo, that shit was
even
crazy.
When you when he said a brother knew who's known for his rap to Jeppy Jeppy.
A brother who's known for his rap, Jappy Jap. Larry Ladd, third, least not last.
Like, why did you just put that piece
right
but
there?
That shit sounds hard, man. That's just screwed up, just honest face shit, man. You know what I'm saying? Like I man.
Legendized.
So, Preem. You were a lot was self-taught, or did you have, you know, a lot of people around you to show you around the studio? Because I remember you were talking earlier.
Man, I had no experience. Okay. When I came to work on, when I finally got signed to Gangstar, I brought my coffin with all my turntables and mixes all in one coffin. I'm thinking that because my demo was made on a 4-track. Shout out to my man Ian Skeet in East New York. He used to let me use his 4-track machine at his parents' house. We lived next to each other at the time. And with Skeet, he showed me how to overlap everything because I would just keep cutting the record on beat and right. for like 5 minutes. And that's a track. Next one, do whatever. That's a track. Do next one, do whatever. Everything was just looping two copies of everything. I didn't have a drum machine. So they sounded like fresh samples, but they were all configured that way. Mm-hmm. As far as learning how to find it, and my boy that Carlos Garza, who got me the job at the record store in Texas at Sound Waves, he had an SP-12, mm-hmm. and he let me borrow it so I could see if I could figure it out. And I kind of figured it out, but not. I'm still trying to understand how the samples sound with that dirty old sound is going in the machine, mm-hmm. and I still couldn't figure it out, but. Just doing whatever I did to get it to a point, I had a little bit of understanding. When I signed the Gangstar, the SP-1200 was out, and at the studio, the engineer that owned the studio shot the Slow-Mo Sonnenfeld.
Slow-Mo.
He is the one that would show me how to make the sample go in there, because I knew what I wanted to cut off the record to put into the machine, and then he was like, he was showing me how, I was like, well, how can I make that sample cut this one off? And how can I do this and this? Mm. He showed me all of that. At that time, me, Guru, and Slow-Mo would be side by side, all three of us. And I'll be like, you hit the hi-hat. I'm hit the 808 and I'm hit the snare. And you do the sample. Okay, you ready? Go. Okay. Yeah. Now stop. Okay, now let me do my thing, do it again. Okay, I like that. We'd high five, we feel like we're you're so excited, like, yo, this beat's coming together. So No More Mr. Nice Guy, our first Gangstar album, production-wise, it's me and Slow-Mo and Guru hitting the buttons together.
Wow.
That's why it sounds like it does.
These are the words that I manifest. I manifest.
Once it got to the point of where Guru was like, yo, as far as you getting paid, you can only get 50% if you produce everything on your own, and we don't use Slow-Mo for that. So because you don't write rhymes, so in order to get 50%, you gotta learn how to produce beats. So I was like, all right. So I got me an SP-1200 of my own. And then King of Chill used to let me go to his parents' house to learn how to loop on an S950 Akai sampler, and S900 first, and then the 950, which had more memory time. But, and think about it, it's only 60 seconds, and that's if you had one that's blown out. Right. So blown out, people, this means it's been expanded, like just like when you put rims on a car. This one had rims.
Right.
So, I would learn that without even having anything to trigger it with at King of Chill's house. And he said, yo, you should buy an Alessis drum machine. It's really small and you can put the outputs on this and this and this, and it'll be able to trigger the S950. So I did that. The first record that I actually made a beat was Step in the Arena, which ended up being the name of our first album on a major.
In the arena or forum, we can seize our floor.
And once I learned how to do that, I just started making beats every day to make that album. And then I felt like I got better. And then by the time 1992 came around, when we did Dwig and Take It Personal and Next Girl and Next Girl, that last beat I ever did on the SP-1200 was Take It Personal. And I said, I'm going to leave it alone and start working on an MPC 60, because my engineer at D&D Studios, Eddie Sancho, was telling me the way you program, you should actually use this. It's more geared towards the way you put everything down. So I said, well, I've been doing stuff on the SP-1200. I'm at least do one more beat before I put it to rest. And Take It Personal was the last one I ever did, 1992.
Wow.
And around that time is when I started to get confident, because now we had to get the Gangstar Foundation born. We had Lil Dab from the Group Home on our album, on I'm the Man, J. Ruth Damager. He started being, talked about. So that is when I felt confident that I could now be a producer. Because I told Guru when I joined the group, I want to produce outside of the group. If you don't want me to do that, then I don't want to be in Gangstar, because that was my dream, is to produce different people, how your name was on different artists' records. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be the same way. And he was like, nah, you can produce outside of the world. He said, as long as we're not, touring and stuff like that, then I want you to, do just with us. And that's how we've always done it. He'll work on projects. I'll work on projects. He's like, yo, I'm ready to start another album, and we'll start. And we'll go back to make. And we always make sure we also do hot shit as well, because I don't want us to have whack shit and I'm producing outside of the group, and they, and they're getting hits and we're making, you know, just stuff that's not really moving. And I think we were very, very consistent, you know, like an EPMD with every album.
Who reached out to you for the Illmatic project?
Large Professor, shout to Extra P. Because I look at him as how what I am to Guru is, you know, Premier to Guru. I feel like that's Nas's Premier, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Like Large Pro brought Nas, he gave Nas a sound. You got to have a sound. That's what you do, Marley. Like, no matter what record you sampled and hooked up, you gave it a sound that still sounds like it's yours, you know. That's and people said. don't understand that.
That's
you know,
Kane
you make it sound like it's yours, even no matter where it's from. You know what I'm saying? So, with that said, that's the reason why as I started to expand and get more into understanding production techniques and whatnot. I always focused on making sure a sound is established.
Gotcha.
Still do.
So what was those sessions like when you started, as you moved from Gangsta and then you started doing Illmatic with Nas?
Well, for one, I used to hang out with Large Pro when he was the main source. So he was the one that was like, yo, man, you got to check out. At that time, he called him the rapper Nas. He said, yo, you got to check out this dude, the rapper Nas. Yo, you know, like he was saying it like that. And because, you know, Large Professor talks so New York. Like he's everything. He could just look at you and it's just New York. That's. You know what I'm saying? Like yo, word. You know what I'm saying? Like word.
Right
up. Like that's Large Pro, man. And he told me about him, Akinelli. I met Joe Fatal. They had just done the record.
Oh, and the barbecue?
Like, check. Yeah, he said, check this out. And I went over there to hear it. And I was like, yo, man. You know, to hear the, obviously, when I was 12, I went to Hell for Snuff and Jesus. Obviously, that blew everybody's mind. And I'm iller than an AIDS patient and all that stuff. So,
verbal assassin, my architect pleases. When I was 12, I went to Hell for Snuff and Jesus. Nasty Nazis.
When it came to that, and then the next record you drop from Large Pro is Halftime. But for the Zebrahead soundtrack, we were like, yo, this shit is
mean. It ain't a damn thing gonna change. I'm gonna perform a strange show. The mic warmer was born the game. Nas, why did you do it? You know you got the mad fat fluid when you rhyme. It's halftime.
And I would always go to Chung King, do a lot of sessions. I'd be a power play with Large Professor. I was there when Large Professor was working on Coogee Rap and Polo's second album, Wanted Dead Alive. I was there to watch a lot of those sessions go down. And that was an experience. So all of this is just making me better when it's my turn to put out something else, you know?
Legendize.
So tell me about your first time working with B.I.G. in the studio.
First time working with...
How did B.I.G. get on your radar?
Mr. C. We lived in Clinton Hill. Me and Guru lived in Branford Marcellus's brownstone.
Oh,
and
okay.
We lived on Washington between Lafayette and Green. Big, and then would be on Washington and Fulton on the Ave, just chilling every weekend. So whenever we go, wanted to go to the weed spot or go get a 40 when I was drinking 40s of OE. I never liked saying odds. It was always OE tradition.
Yeah.
We see Big and Junior Mafia out there, and they knew we lived up the block. So they was already like, man, you got to put me on and get me in the game. And I knew Puff was already working with getting them put on. Right. So I was like, yo, Puff going to blow your shit up. He going to make sure that you're promoted right and all that, but I will do a record with you. So pretty much every weekend, me, Guru, Shug, Dap, J-Ru, we would always go down there and just hang with him and D-Rock and Chico, Nino, Kim, C's, Clep, who else? Gunna, everybody would be there.
Oh, wow.
There.
Yes, everyone. And Jay Rose.
Yeah. You know, so we were just on some hangout shit. And
wow.
But I would go to this new weed spot that had opened. I won't say the street, but Mr. C lived like literally a block over. I'd always park over where Mr. C's apartment was so that if there was a raid or a bust, my car wouldn't be on that block where right. the spot was. But we would go in there, load up on a whole bunch of bags and go right back to the pad, roll up and smoke. And at that time, when you rolled a blunt in public, even the police wasn't really tripping off of what it was. You know, later on, when they start seeing just a cigar, they would always just assume that you got weed on you and try to you know, stop and frisk.
Oh, yeah.
But during that time, it was just an everyday hangout thing. Chubb Rock would be in the neighborhood because he lived down the block. Lady of Rage and Nikki D lived together. They were roommates. Mm. So we'd hang out with them. Shout to Nikki Nicole. Who else lived over there? April Walker from Walkerware.
Wow.
Lived two blocks behind us. Cause she and Jam Master Jay were a couple at the time. So we'd always see Jay. and then what else? Around that time, it just happened to be one of those days that Big was wrapping up his album because we had already heard it in the earlier stages
right.
of when Warning and all that was done. Because we see Rapping is Fundamental used to come over to our house all the time.
Easy Mo-B.
Easy Mo-B. Yeah, yeah. The whole squad. RZA used to come to our house. Genius, which is the GZA, used to come to our house. Mm. man, our house was the spot to stop by.
It was
always something going on.
Yeah, it sounded like a Harlem Renaissance type affair. Okay.
Oh, so with Big, when he was wrapping up his album and updating it, then he was just like, yo, I need that one gutter joint for the streets. And I was really not in a creative mode that day, but I said, look, just come up to D&D and I'll see what I can come up with. And that's why I had those little stabs. It's just one note, but I have it going boom, 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 and tuned it on all the keys.
Right.
And just said boom, 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 boom. And then when Big got there, he was like, yo, switch it up a little bit on the hook. So that's why I just said boom, 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 boom. You know, and Ooh. He was like, that's it. And he cut it real quick. One or two takes. He was really fast. No, didn't write it down.
Mm.
And I remember we're heading back to Brooklyn maybe two or three days after I did it for him and gave him the final mix. Me and Gordon heading back to BK. And a car pulls up to us right where we began to get on the Brooklyn Bridge. And we hear unbelievable blasts, and I'm like, yo, how the hell is they have the record when we just did it like 3 days ago? And we roll up on him like, yo, where you get that from? He said, oh, it's on Hot 97, Flex is playing it. It was an acetate that they had just mastered at Hit Factory because, you know, I think Tom Coyne did it, and or either Tom Coyne or Chris. What was it, Garinger? I think it was Chris Garinger. But they gave me an acetate and they gave one to Flex. And Flex was playing the acetate. And it just by coincidence happened to be blasting when we're heading to Brooklyn and somebody's listening to it in the car. And they were like, nah, this is on the radio. Mm. And that's when I was like, oh, okay, this is going to rock. And they rocked that whole summer, too.
If I said it, I meant it. Bite my tongue for no one. Call me evil or unbelievable.
You mentioned earlier that you were staying at Branford Marsalis. What was that? How did that relationship form?
Because when we put out the No More Mr. Nice Guy album, Spike Lee had seen Words on Manifest video. And during that time, he was working on Mo Better Blues, the movie. And he wanted to do a rap. So he always works with hip-hop artists in some type of way, you know, Do the Right Thing, yeah, P.E. This particular one, he wanted to use a jazz-oriented subject. On the No More Mr. Nice Guy album, we had a song called Jazz Music. But for one, he saw the Words on Manifest video and he said Guru resembled Malcolm X with the jawbone and the way he looked in the video. So that intrigued him to buy the album to see what else we had. And when he saw Jazz Music and listened to that, he was like, damn, this is a good song, but they left out a lot of names that should be mentioned. So he had this poem from a guy named Eric Eli, who it was a poem that didn't rhyme, but it was still a poem. And he gave that to he said, I want y'all to do a newer version of Jazz Music, but go off of this poem because it has a lot of names that should be mentioned. So Guru just took that and just would take little lines and just put his own lines around it And then they said Branford Marcellus is going to be the producer of the song. So we met him. And once we got cool with each other working in the studio, we did more of a big band. You know, he had all musicians and everything. Right. My original version was me just looping up two records and then transforming just a humming noise. And that one ended up being in the video because Spike wanted to simplify the song in a video because the one on the soundtrack is very elaborate with different chains ups and whatnot.
And all the listeners' ears, fulfilling the needs and planting the seeds of a jazz fan.
So I was talking about how we were looking for a new place to move to in Brooklyn because we were living in the Bronx. We had moved from East New York to 183rd Street in the Bronx. Shout out to the third. And that's how I met Malachi the Nutcracker. That's how I met Panty from NYG.
Oh, okay.
That's how I met. Yeah, that's how I met Smiley the Ghetto Child because they lived up that way. So when we lived up there and we were moving back to Brooklyn, Branford was like, yo, man, I just got a new gig being the music director of The Tonight Show because Johnny Carson's about to step down and Jay Leno's taking over. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be moving. If y'all want to rent my place and with the possibility of buying it later, y'all can rent from me and y'all can move in. But I need to live there at least another 2 months so we can just all live together with me and my wife, my son, and you and Guru can move in downstairs. And that's what we did. We moved in and lived with him and his wife and his son, Reese, and stayed there for a few months. And I remember Guru and I would always come home drunk because he said you could use our home phone so you could check messages. And, you know, back then you always had an answering machine in the house. We'd be on there. We come in the middle of the night, 4 a.m, thinking nobody's downstairs. Branford's on the couch, sleep, because he's having a bad day and just wants to be alone. And we in there going, beep. Hey, yo, man, yo, give me a call, nigga. You know, something like that.
He's getting
up going, yo, man, why do y'all got to check the machine at 4 a.m? Like, yo, you told me to use your phone number, you know. So, and this is before cell phones and walking around with cell phones, unless you had a car phone, which we did. But that one wasn't detachable. So that's how the Branford connection happened. And then once, like about 2 or 3 months passed, he moved to L.A. His wife moved out. His son moved. And me and Guru had the place. And then we turned that into a straight Animal House frat party every day. It was a party every day in that brownstone. If Branford would have seen how we were living in there, he would have been like, yo, get out now. But he left a drum. He left a drum kit there. And I used to play it all the time. Me and Dap used to battle because he didn't know how to play drums. And I was showing him, no, you do the stick like this and do it like that. And he'd get on, let me do one. And everybody would just start freestyling, being silly and stuff. One day, Dap just starts rhyming. And we're like, oh, shit, Dap's rhyming. Doing a rhyme. Your voice sound. Yo, we should do a record. Like, that's how he ended up getting a verse, you know, because he just sounded, you know, I'm on the drum. You know, just doing shit like that. Then he would do it, and I'd say some silly raps, and everybody else over there is, you know, 40'd up, and everybody rhyming. And that is how all of the extensions happen, you know, except for Suge. Big Suge was the founder of Gangstar with Guru, in Boston. So they, and Suge's brother was the first DJ, so that was the first Gangstar, you know. So that's how everything started to gel together once I joined the group.
Legendize.
This is the story of how a film gets made. Starring Josh Rubin.
It's his first feature.
You Were the Worst's Aya Cash.
Can we not do this right now?
And SNL's Chris Redd.
He's not doing it for a paycheck.
Okay. I'll see y'all.
Join us for the making of Scare Me, a horror comedy from the brilliant mind of Josh Rubin.
This year you're going to make a movie no matter what.
Tear down the fourth wall of filmmaking with our crack team of investigators.
Don't you come at me and try to get me to spill some stuff.
This is Make Cool Shit, hosted by Aaron Hieffetz.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Season 1, Make a Movie.
3, 2, 1.
Everywhere you enjoy podcasts.
So I guess I'm going to learn the film business.
Legendize.
So tell me, as a producer, why is it important for you to mix your records?
Because not only do you have the sound not everybody knows how to, like Guru would say, rest in peace, man. Guru would always say, the engineer and the producer know how to make it glow. When you know, like you may lay it down, everything ain't EQ'd yet, but he said, we know how to make it glow. And he said, that's when you know it's ready, to, you know, it's finished. There's so many records, man. It might be dope rhymes, dope beat, but the mix is so bad.
Yeah.
It's to where sometimes I don't even want to play it because it sounds like it's not like it's a work in progress.
Sound like.
And they're like, no, it's done. It's like, nah.
It's done, kid.
As dirty as Wu-Tang records and some notes were out of key, it was just right. It was right. It matched the artist that he picked to be on the record. It was like, it was right. You know, shout out to RZA, man. That shit was right. He told us he was going to put together this crew. But when he was still Prince Rakim on Tommy Boy, he told us he was going to do this.
That's dope.
You know, you hear it, but not where you're like, oh man, I'm going to be waiting for it every day to see when it happens. It was just kind of like, oh, okay, cool. And he did it.
I think this is, you know, you're talking about production and sampling. This is a perfect time to include Primo in our Who Chopped Your segment. What we do, Prem, on our episodes, we take a sample and we listen to it, and then we hear how other producers have used the same sample, and we talk about it. So first we play the original, and then we're going to play some producers that used it and some artists. We want to include you in this particular one, all right?
All right, let me see if I know it.
Who chopped you?
In this segment of the game, you're going to find out who chopped you.
Hi-ya! What the?
Who chopped you? Who chopped you?
Who chopped you? Ding, 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 ding,
ding. So tell them about the first sample we got, Marley.
All right, the first sample we got today, it's by the Fatback Band, Baby, I Want You, in 1972. Here it goes, right here.
You gotta see Preem's expression right now.
It's so funky.
Now, see, there's two parts that were sampled from them. Here's the second part right here.
That sounds like some of my music off the bridge.
I'm going to tell you who. Let's play this joint by Busta Rhymes featuring, since you mentioned RZA, ODB, Where's Your Money? Produced by Tommy Spearman in 2005. Let's listen to this one.
Yo, all my skifters that make money, throw your motherfucking hands in the air.
All my girls making money.
All cars get taken over because of money, baby. All businesses, baby, it's all about the money. To all my niggas that busting shots for money right now, bust shots. Bust shots for the money now.
How'd you like that sample chop right there?
That's crazy. Oh. And
hot.
Yo, in 1999, Mos Def, the song Mathematics, DJ Premier chopped it up like this.
Bucka, 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 bucka. Ha ha. Even the grain goes. Yo, check it, one for Charlie Hustle, two for Steady Rock, three for the fourth coming live, future shot. It's five dimensions, six senses, seven.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, that's what that was?
Oh, you sound like Marley. Sometimes, like,
that's what that was?
You know, we'll be in Japan or Tokyo, and we'll just be visiting a record store, and people will run up to Marley with the actual song that he used in the song, or that he sampled. And I'd be like, yo, could you sign this? And Molly be like, when did I use this? What song did I use this?
I used this song.
And looking at your facial expression, because I thought you might have recognized it when we first played it, but when you played it with Mos Def, then I guess you realize that you had chopped it up?
Oh, no. I knew what it was.
Okay, okay.
When you played it.
Because I saw your face, like, I was like,
oh, that's what that is. That's part of the no snitching family, you know.
Right. Okay. Do you remember that production?
Oh, yeah, man. You know, Mos Def is very unique. We were actually part of the same management. Patrick Moxie was Gangstar's manager, back then. And he started Payday Records, and actually the first artist he had on there was Mos Def, DCQ, and Mos Def's sister. They were called UTD, Urban Thermodynamics. And that was the first.
Explain that.
And then Showbiz and AG got signed after that, and then J. Ru got signed. Then Group Home, then Big Shug, Dub C, OC, you know, and on, but Payday became a label to be reckoned with. And, you know, to revisit once Mos Def went to Raucus and he wanted me on his first, you know, solo album, I already knew I had to go really abstract with it, but funky.
Yeah.
So tell me about this, the Christina Aguilera record you made back in the day. When you made it, like, did you think that people would look at you as a different type of producer because you showed that side?
I remember when they put the word out that I was going to work with her, there was, you know, this before social media, people were like, oh man, Preem going for that commercial stuff. He's going to be like everybody else in the band and hip hop. And it's like, no, she wants my sound and style. And that's what I gave her, you know? And we clicked right away because she was like, these are records I like, which happened to be some Group Home records. She liked Pitch Black. It's All Real. She was into Capone Noriega and, you know, stuff like that. But she said, I wanted to have the jazzy feel, but just hard drums, hard beats, and just you flip it just a whole different way for my style of singing, but still keep it you. And the first one we did was called Back in the Day, which I love a lot. That was the first one we recorded. We was only supposed to do that one. She liked the vibe and was like, let's keep going. We started working on more. And the last one that we did out of the five was Ain't No Other Man, which became a single and my first Grammy for a pop single, which was a big deal for me to get that because I had gotten a Grammy for D'Angelo's Voodoo for being producing a song on there with Devil's Pie, working on Jay-Z's Hard Knock Life album.
Right.
I got a guy with a Grammy for that, but that's also being involved with producing the song on the album. But to get one for just a single off the album, it was more of a big monument for me because that one record from the album is being singled out as Grammy winning. And that made me feel good that we were able to go that distance and still stay premier with the sound. Do your thing, honey. Ain't no other man can stand up next to you. Ain't no other man on the planet does what you do. You're the kind of guy. I wasn't really worried about everybody giving me flack because I knew what I was going to bring once they heard it. And I'm really good at shutting people up. So physically, mentally, whatever with Tully you want it to be. But that one was really special to do that. And we became the best of friends, went to her wedding. She was in the process of getting married during the making of the album. So it was a fun time working with her, man. Shout out to Kanye West, too, because we were working at Record Plant. And then I remember the first day we worked there, Madonna's in one room, Macy Gray's in another room, Limp Bizkit's in another room, we're in another room. It was just like, and paparazzi's outside, you know, just trying to catch everybody because Macy Gray was huge at the time.
Right.
Madonna, she in the studio, and Limp Bizkit was big, and then me and Christina in another room. And it got booked where she couldn't get more sessions in, and she was like, damn, man, we got to find a way to finish recording in LA while you out here. And Kanye was like, yo, you need to go to the studio that I'm doing a listening party to. Why don't you come check it out? I went to the listening party. I liked the sound of the room. And we ended up using the studio that he brought us to. And we were rocking from that point on.
Did you ever feel at any time that you had put hip hop on your shoulders to represent in this massive pop genre working on this project?
on Christina's.
Right.
Definitely to make sure that hip hop knows that I'm going to still stay true to what made me, you know, shine in this culture as a producer and a DJ. I never wanted to be looked at like, oh, you abandoned what made you great. I always feel like every artist, whatever audience gravitated to you first, whatever you drop, anytime you make more music, make sure you cater to them first. Even if you do one that's mainstream, make sure if it's album oriented, you always drop your street record first to show that you still know how to do it that way. That's why a lot of artists, once they've gone platinum, double platinum, they're billionaires, trillionaires, whatever, still show me you can go back to the basics and make just a raw ass record, because no matter how comfortable you are, yeah, you ain't gotta say you broke or you struggling on the block. You can still just rap about how nice you are when it comes to spitting rhymes. And I feel like that's something you should always be able to do. That's why when you see rock artists and they're down to their last gray hair before they go bald, they're still touring, doing arenas and stadiums. So why are we stopping? Keep it funky.
James Brown kept going.
Yeah, but some people just need to stop, though. Let's be honest.
Some people need to stop, for sure.
Or a lot of people.
You had a relationship with Tupac and Death Row?
Yeah, me and Pac go back to when Digital Underground came out, because we went to our first convention. You know, we had the new music seminars, and now the Jack the Rappers and all that stuff was happening, and the Gavin, and we go, this is our first time going to the Bay Area in 1990. So when we, you know, we seeing all the artists at the hotel and hanging out and going to all the workshops, Humpty Dance was huge.
Mm-hmm.
When we went the second time, same song had just started blowing up.
Tupac, go ahead and rock
now
this.
I clown around when I hang around with the underground. Girls used to frown, say I'm down when I come around. Gas me, and when they pass me, they used to diss me, harass me, but now they ask me if they can kiss me.
And I knew Tupac was always just being a backup dancer for Humpty Dance and in the group with Digital. Rest in peace to Shock G as well, too, man. Big loss. You know, we were always in contact year after year. In the last 5 years, we've been in contact real heavy. So Money B and DJ Fuse from Digital Underground were roommates. They had a house party. Me and Guru go there. That's why you see that picture with Pac and Guru with the Fear of a Black Planet album poster on the behind them, and Tupac shooting the middle finger. That's at the party. We're just in Money B's bedroom chilling the smoke because all the girls are coming in. It's getting packed in the house. So, you know, the only room where we could just smoke for a minute and then go back out there and smoke with everybody else. Cause, you know, back then, once the weed is passed around to everybody, you know, it's gone real fast.
Yeah, you don't see it again.
So while the girls are coming in, we're just hanging out for a minute, just kicking it. And that's how that picture was taken, with them sitting side by side. And I'm probably standing in the corner, you know, just getting blazed. And then that day, Pac was like, yo, I just got signed to this label that's not known yet called Interscope. He said they're really nobody on their roster, but I'm going to do everything I can to blow this label up. But I got a new video called Trap coming out. He said, just stay tuned for it. And then a couple months later, the video came out. I was like, oh, that's the one he was talking about.
They got me trapped.
So from that point, I used to hang out with Greg Nice from Nice and Smooth a lot, and Tupac would always be at his pad, and he would call me, yo, Pac here. I'm like, oh, okay, we go over there. Showbiz and Drez had this house where it was split, but they owned both parts of the house. Mm-hmm. This is when Choice is Yours was all, and DITC was clocking, Show was clocking.
Oh, okay, wow.
And Pac would be over there, you know. So this is like normal shit that was, Pac was that cool with us, you know what I'm saying? This is before he was on Death Row. I was, I knew Suge Knight and all of them because of Lady of Rage, because Rage, like I said, used to live in Brooklyn with Nikki D right down the block. Right. So I used to hang with them all the time. Every day I'd go over there and hang out with Rage and Nikki. So when she was trying to get her demos out and they weren't working, she told me, yo, I'm moving to California and I'm going to find Dr. Dre and I'm going to get him to sign me. I was like, that's a big wish. If you do it, that's going to be dope. But I wish you all the best. She moved. Didn't see her for like a year, maybe roughly that. We had a show in L.A. at the Palladium, and I remember she worked security. You know, they have those yellow jackets that says security on the back of the black letters. Yeah. And she's like, yo, what's up? Because, you know, we're the headliner for the show, Gangstar, and we're like, yo, what you doing? How you doing out here? You can see Dre. She goes, yes. He signed me. He got a new label called Death Row. And I was like, word? Mm. When's the record coming? She said, soon. And she got this new guy named Snoop Doggy Dog. And we got the Death Row, the inmates. You know, it's us and the Dog Pound and this guy named Hey Dog. He sings. And it's just a whole bunch of us. She's all excited. And she's like, but, you know, the labels hasn't gotten off the ground yet, but it's going to be popping. And the next thing you know, the Chronic drops. You know, once that drops, it was just on and popping. So I had met Suge way back in the early stages of that. So we've been cool for a long time. Hold your head, Suge. You know, I know it's rough on the inside not being out with your family and loved ones.
So I remember Robin used to work at Chung King.
Yep, sure did. She'd be with Ari B.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, she worked at Chung King. She just used to sleep on the couch all the time.
No doubt, no doubt.
Matter of fact, I had an MPV with a dope sound system, and I was listening to a test mastered version of the Stephanie Arena album. We had a song called Precisely the Right Rhymes. Mm. And that subwoofer was in the back. So I had a 50 hertz tone 808 that I stressed. Ooh. So, you know, with that, you're not going to hear that on any normal speaker. You got to hear it on woofers that can take that frequency. Ooh. Nikki D had her, you know, she was the first lady on Def Jam, had her release party. Then since they lived near me, I said, they were getting ready to leave. I said, I'll give y'all a ride home. I said, you mind if I test out one of these songs I want to hit in my car? She's like, yeah, turn it all the way up. Precisely the Right Rhymes had that 50 hertz tone. So instead of it going boom, boom, it says, ooh. Mm-hmm.
My subject matter and context are blessed.
Rage goes, ooh, what kind of 808 is that? And she's sitting in the back. I'm like, you know, a girl going, ooh, 808. I'm behind the wheel going.
She's like, what kind of 808 is that, homie?
And she goes, yo, do that again. It goes, ooh. I'm like, yo, I like you. That's because this is my first time meeting her. Right. And, you know, and then we got cool. So being that she knew about sound and all of that, and then when I heard her on the Chronic, I was like, that's her. On it's the one that goes, this should be played at high volume, preferably in a residential district. Boom. Burn it.
And that little shit you hear in the background, that's my homegirl Rage. So all VX kick this shit.
Seven execution style.
High powered. That's what it was.
So I want you to tell me, in your opinion, what is the most important element to a song? What's the most important element to a song?
Most important element to a song?
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's about the getting them drums right. Because I don't care what instrument you play.
Yep.
The particular snare, the particular kick, the particular hi-hat or no hi-hat or, you know, everything, the wrong snare can make a dope sample sound not right. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with the kick, you know. So I always value looking for different sounds that put you into experimenting until it's the right ones that hit the musical side of it. You know, so, and I mean, you think about our ancestors, they communicated with the drums. So it's boom, boom, pap, boom, ba, doom, pap.
Now, your production has contributed to like three of the greatest hip hop albums in history from Biggie, Jay, and Nas. And your resume is long. Are there any artists that you haven't worked with that you still desire to work with?
Man, I said it before, I wish I could have worked with X, you know, rest in peace, DMX. That was always a big wish of mine. Ghostface Killah. Me and Ghostface worked on a remix recently that's about to drop. This group called Emotional Oranges.
From out in the West Coast.
Yeah. The
dope funk R&B type group.
Yeah, they have a song called Built That Way that I did a remix on. And they wanted Ghostface, so Ghostface wrote two verses on it, but that's still not the same as me going in to just do a raw dog, ugly you know, scrunch your face up, ghost Supreme joint. So I still look forward to doing that. Him and Ray, you know. So Ray and Ghost. Who else would I want to work with on some rhyme and shit? You know what I like, man? I actually like DaBaby.
Okay.
For the younger generation.
Yeah.
Because, but I would still keep it in boom bap mode and have him do his verse to that. Because I watched him freestyle on a couple of things that was more of our era beats. And I was like, oh, okay. He can do both. I think you should be versatile as a producer, even though you should never abandon what, like I said, what made you great. Marley had the grimiest production style, especially in 86, 87, 88. But then you mix on BLS during lunchtime from that noon, and you're playing all these just crazy disco and classics and house, and you didn't play any just raw gutter hip hop, which showed that you had versatility with your music knowledge and your DJ knowledge, because you were able to switch gears and rock that, and all that stuff sounded dope at noon. And Friday nights, Saturday nights, you know, you had the Rap Attack, and you would just, it would just be so New York hood, ghetto, dark, raw.
Legendized.
How did the Drake project happen?
Drake, I've known him for several years too, just in passing. And we were always cool. So with this particular album on Scorpion, I'm really close with 40, who's his one of Drake's best friends, and he is the sound of OVO and the whole family of Drake. So we got cool as well. And 40 told me that Drake had this sample that his man, Manish, he's a guy that just makes sample packs that he creates, and then you just make beats out of them. He said this one particular one reminded him of his mother, and he felt like I'm the one that could program the right drums to it and make it bounce. So back to drums, obviously. And so that Drake was like, yo, if you could flip this one, I'll do something to it. I flipped it in like an hour, sent it back. I remember I went to bed like 5 a.m. I got up early, like 6:30 in the morning, just to, because I just did. And when I looked at my phone, 40 had a video of the Pro Tools, and he could hear Drake's voice of the verse being laid.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, damn, he laid it down. All right. And then I looked at later that day, and it had a old picture of me actually from the Nas Illmatic promo. And he has a scorpion on my jacket. And I was like, oh, I guess I made the album then, because they had never confirmed. But I was like, the fact that I'm on his IG story, and it's got the scorpion on my coat. I was like, I guess we're in there. And then the next thing you know, they reached out and said, let's finalize all the BI. And I made Sandra's Rose, which, you know, his mother's Sandra. So
get all of you niggas scratched like Primo. Worms, I just opened up a can of those. My mother had a flower shop, but I was Sandra's Rose.
How'd that make you feel? Because him being a part of the newest generation and then you, you know, still being heard with that crowd. How'd that make you feel?
You know, I've always wanted to work with Drake anyway. I see all the stupid comments. Oh, why would you want to work with him? I've even seen people go, man, hip hop is over now. I'm never listening to you again. And I replied and said, good. we don't want you no way. You know, we're fine without you.
That's crazy.
Get on about your business, bitch.
So tell me something. If it wasn't the drum machine or the turntable, what is something you couldn't live without other than the drum machine and turntable in the studio?
I got to have a bass. I've said this about 20 times in interviews, but I'll say it again. Travis Scott's father, Jack Webster, that's his father's name, because Travis' real name is Jack Webster as well. Jacques Webster, but we call him Jack. His dad was one of my mentors, taught me how to play drums. And then Jack's brother, Travis, is the one that used to play the bass, and they would be jamming in their game room in their parents' house. And my father used to play cards with their parents.
Oh, wow.
So they would play cards every week, and I would go over there and just learn how to get funky on the drums. And I've always been the bass, especially once I saw Bootsy from Bootsy's Rubber Band. You know, it was shaped like a star, and I was like, yo, this is a dope-ass bass. And I I was always in the Parliament and just all the way the structure sounded, and same thing with James Brown.
Hey!
So I was like, yo, I want to also learn the bass, which I did. I was into the Brothers Johnson, you know, because Travis used to always play a lot of Louis Johnson parts. And I was just like, yo.
Hello.
So bass has to be in here, which we have four of them. Shout out to Brady Watt. And we even have an up right now because Stanley Clark did a session with Brady and told Brady, if you really want to master playing the bass, you got to get an upright and learn that. And Brady borrowed one from a friend of his here in New York, started just practicing. Now he gets down on the upright. And that's dope that, you know, Stanley, like, you can be as nice as you want to be on the bass. If you've never learned an upright, the same thing with me, with if you DJ clubs and you have the little...
The controller.
Is that the Roland? Yeah. The one that has the two CDJs or whatever, and the fader's already on there. But you still got to learn to rock on a pair of 12s. No matter how you DJ, get on those 12s and show me you can get down. If you can't do that, you're still a button pusher DJ.
Button pusher. So are you using any new technology in your production?
I moved up to the MPC Renaissance, you know, Akai. I'm still not into the software version more, but the advantage is better because now you throw it all in there, you back it up. There's no more floppy disks. I'm actually about to release a series called So What's Up about all the floppy disks I use. And I show the original disk and talk about what happened during that session and then launch it and all that stuff. So be on the lookout for So What's Up, the Floppy Disk Chronicles. But the software version of the MPC took me some getting used to because, for one, I'm not used to laying stems. I'm used to bouncing everything to 2-inch tape straight from 8 outputs.
Right.
From the S950 into 2-inch tape. So to take stems, have to put it on the thumb drive and then move it over and then dump the stems. And sometimes they won't start exactly on the one. You got to rebounce it again. And, you know, it's all that computer stuff. It's hit or miss, you know. Yeah. So I've just gotten used to it now. The one thing that I still do for the most part is I still treat it like I still only have 60 seconds. That way, I have to make something really unique and cool under that little bit of time.
What was the importance to you for taking over D&D when they was deciding to close down? Why was that important for you?
Taking over D&D, which we renamed it after our homie that just passed away. His name was Headquarters, Kenneth Walker. Head of Bosnia's Open, word is bond. That's what he used to always say. You know, every time, no matter what, when he's about to say peace out, yo, I love you, my nigga. Yo, he used to talk like that, like he gritting his teeth. Yo, I love you, nigga. Yo, word is bond. And he'd always say word is bond, like almost make you jump. D&D was in the process of closing while we were going on the owner's tour for Gangstar. And I'm like, yo, we haven't finished the album. What are we going to do if D&D closes? They were like, yo, we're going to try to do our best to keep it open before you get back. And when we got back, the doors were locked. We still had about 4 songs to finish. Rakim was like, yo, I got a studio that Roberta Flack, the legend, told me to work out because he knew Roberta Flack. And that was Avatar. Went to Avatar to finish the album. Dave from D&D and Doug introduced me to the landlord, and they were like, yo, maybe y'all can work out a deal and you take it over, because if anybody that we want to give the blessing to, since you've been there for so long, even though the Beat Miners were there a lot, you know, Showbiz Nate G was there a lot, and of course, Jay-Z was there a lot, you know, during that time, like 96, 97, you know, anybody from Gangstar, so that was normal. But I met with the landlord. He looked like a troll. I think he passed away recently, but he looked like a troll. And he goes, well, I'm going to give you a post-it note, and I'm going to write a number. And then you're going to write a number, and you're going to slide it over to my desk on my side, and I'll tell you if I'll use that number or not. Go down, but I'm willing to pay a month. Slid it to him. He goes, looks like your number is not going to make it.
Oh, here, shit.
See you later, buddy. And I was like, yo, you can't work it out. He's like, nope. So I went on tour. We were gone for about almost 3 weeks. The day that we're coming back from the tour, his name was Mitch. Mitch reaches out to me and goes, do you still want the police? That's how he talked to. still want the police, the number that you gave me? I was like, yeah. He goes, it's yours.
Dope.
I had a house in Long Island that I wasn't living in. I sold it and I took that money to open the studio and buy all brand new equipment. D&D let us get the speakers back, the Uris. So we were able to get those. I bought a brand new board, just gave it the place a facelift and left everything else the way it was. And from there, we said, well, we don't want to call it D&D because that tradition is Dave and Doug all day, and we don't want to, you know, step on that. So we were like, headquarters, he spelled it H-E-A-D, and then Q-C-O-U-R-T-E-R-Z. And I, we used to make fun of how he spelled it. He was like, yo, but I'm unique, and that's the way I'm going to spell it. You know. So I said, you know what? Now it's special. After he passed, you know, me and his mother got very, very close. I got very close with his stepfather, his sister, and the rest of his family, his brother, Ramal, and sister, Tiff. When he passed, his mother wanted me to dress him in the casket. She was like, yo, I want him. I want to see his feet. I want the whole casket open. I don't want it half closed. She said, make him look hip hop. That's exactly what she said. Make him look hip hop. And then she said, no dark colors. And, you know, he's always wearing velour sweatsuits of every color. So I got like a bright powder blue color. Got the Nike hot tops with the blue, light blue swoosh on the side. Got the baseball hat, the velour zip up, and dressed him like that in the casket for viewing and everything. And she was satisfied and she started to feel like she could trust me. And I was like, hey, I want to name the studio after headquarters. She was like, yo, you got my blessing. So that's where we went with headquarters.
Dope.
Legendize.
You know, we definitely, I say we, I'm talking for all the listeners and all the people who listen to Gangsta. Thank you for one of the best yet. I know that must have took a different frame of mind for you to get into. Can you just talk about it more?
From when he passed and, you know, his business partner that he was with, obviously we haven't seen eye to eye. But I knew within my soul that he was sitting on stuff that belonged to Guru that should be in my possession because I knew what I could do with it if I got my hands on it. It was almost like poetic justice when Tupac's cousin got lucky. Killed. And yeah, we're lucky. Right. And he was like, yo, let me get the equipment. I could do something with it. I knew that he had to have sessions and stuff because Guru recorded a lot outside of Gangstar. And I said, if he has it, I got to just figure out a way to get it from him. And, you know, finally worked out a number that I was comfortable with. Once I got them, you know, I had to go through steps of making sure that they weren't rhymes I heard before because I know a lot of his rhymes. From there, I had about 30 some tracks. Some of them, there's dope hooks, but the rhyme might not be finished. You know, it's halfway done, or I don't like the way he's delivering it. So I'm like, guys, I got to skip that one. That was not good. But I still wanted to own it because maybe the hook is dope. I could put on a song for a hook. But there were certain ones where there might be three verses, and I'm like, I'm only going to take these two because I can use that one on another song. Start narrowing it down out of the 30. That one definitely a joint. That one definitely a joint. And then I just started piecing it together. It was a lot of nudging and moving it back and cutting it in half and doing all that stuff. But that part I knew how to do because me and Guru have a dope formula when we make albums. So that part was almost fun. Like, oh man, it's going to be fun because I know how he would like it.
Diamonds are forever like family and loyalty, or real rap songs like Cream or my melody. Diamonds are forever like my infinite thought, like respect in the hood that can't be bought.
And I know that he was satisfied with what we did because, you know, some people, when I was reading some of the reviews, they were like, well, some of them, he's a little more amped with his delivery, even though the track is good. And it's like, yo, I explained that I got stuff that we never worked on that belonged to somebody else.
and I'm just, it's almost like remixing it to make it sound like an album. Mm-hmm. So give us an applause for that effort.
Definitely.
Talking about, some of them don't sound exactly like Guru's tone. Of course not. That's when you know that those people are not in tune to the culture, or they're there just to have something to say. That when
exactly.
Yeah, because you can't please everybody all the time.
Yeah.
So it's going to be some asshole somewhere. Like,
I call them something to say people.
Yeah, yeah. It's always somebody sitting there with something to say. That's the niggas in the back.
Yeah.
It's the niggas in the cheap seats.
I'm calling the STSs. Something to say.
Man, I'm gonna take you back to a couple of years ago when you was up in Marley's house. You actually came through Marley's house. I opened the garage door. I introduced myself. You were like, "Oh, I thought you were a lot bigger." Do you remember that? He was like, "Wow, you Kali? I just thought you were bigger." But during the course of the night, Marley was playing joints, you were playing joints, and you actually started to create a beat on the MPC in the A room. I was in the room, I was standing off, and you looked over at me and you told me I could look over your shoulder. So I'm blessed, and I want to thank you for allowing me to look over your shoulder, because I've been mentored by Marley, and then for you to come into the House of Hits and allow me and invite me to look over your shoulder to see your technique and the way how you were doing things, I want to thank you. So
appreciate it.
During your course and your travels, what is the best piece of advice that you have ever received? And do you remember what it was and who it was from?
Honestly, rest in peace to my dad, man. My dad said, "Yo, if you're going to do this thing, because I don't understand what it is, just make sure you make a name that everybody's going to remember in that field of work that you're going to do." And I said, "Pop, trust me, I'm going to do it." And I accomplished that. So, you know, because he was already a prestigious person in our neighborhood, him and my mom. So everybody knows them in our neighborhood. So because we moved to a town, like I said, to Prairie View, from Fifth Ward. So to be known in our neighborhood really, really high level, I wanted to definitely make him proud, even though he still didn't understand it. He knew it was music, but the whole hip hop thing just didn't make sense to him. So, but to say that, like, if you're going to do it, just make sure they know who the fuck you are. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to go that full. And Marley, you were a big influence on that, from watching and listening and buying anything that had your name on it. You were like a Def Jam record. It's like, yo, if you got Marley on it, it's going to be dope. You know what I mean? Like, Def Jam was the same way. You could trust it if it had Def Jam logo on it.
No,
you know, Profile Records, you know, same thing. Tommy Boy Records. All the indies were just so consistent.
Mm-hmm. You know why, too, at that point? Because the majors wasn't even up on rap yet, and they was trying to shut it down. Low. They was trying, like, yeah, we got all these R&B singers, all these big budgets. They getting all this money to go in the studio. We got all this backlog of music, and y'all coming out with rap?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yo, y'all got to chill with that. And, you know, we was like, hell no.
Yeah, fresh records, sleeping bag. You know, Mantronic, Curtis Mantronic, I was a big fan of. You know, you, Rick Rubin, Larry Smith, big time. Howie T, man, you know, obviously the Bomb Squad and Teddy Riley. You know, I see his name on all the records too, way before God.
Oh, yeah.
You know, for him to do the show and go see the
go
doctor.
Go see the doctor.
Go see the doctor.
Gotta bring that fucking sound back, that fucking Yamaha sound.
Shout out to Teddy, man.
Teddy Riley.
That's right.
That's crazy. Well, let me tell you something, man. It's been a pleasure sitting down with you. I just gotta tell you one thing. At this point, between me and my boy Kali Bond,
no doubt,
you have been legendized.
Hey, Preem. If you had a theme song like "I'ma Get You, Sucker," you know how they say every hero has a theme song. What would be yours in the background as you walked into a room or you walking down the block? What theme song would people hear?
I ain't no joke, Eric B. and Rodney. Yes, indeed.
I ain't no joke. Joke.
Can't thank you enough, Preem.
That's real talk. That's real talk, man. We appreciate the love and keep the music coming. We
all
love that.
Yes, indeed. Kali Bond, Marley Marl, my mentor. Legend.
Thanks, Preem.
All right, y'all. Love.
Wow. Wow. DJ Premier and DJ Marley Marl just chopping it up.
Wow. And flies on the wall, y'all. Just listening.
Yeah, and I hope those people in the cheap seats move down a little closer.
Yeah, get out the cheap seats, y'all. Get the fuck out them cheap seats.
Tell
man.
A friend to tell a friend. DM a friend to DM a friend. Email a friend to email a friend. Tell them.
That's what I'm saying.
We here.
Yo, this season was great.
Bananas. Looking forward to some surprises for next season.
That's what I'm saying. We're going to have some shit for your ass. Matter of fact, we got to go on the West Side and get some West Side.
Let's not tell it. Let's just keep it moving.
Appreciate y'all checking us out, man. We do this for y'all. And as a matter of fact, everybody in the room, we appreciate y'all. Thank you very much for this season.
Dan the man.
Make cool shit.
Legendize.
Hey, yo, this is the legendary DJ Marley Marl imitating Premier. Yeah, man.
All right, y'all, keep it funky. Now it's time to smoke one.
Legendize.